Hi, thanks for listening to one of our Sunday talks from the Center for Spiritual Living in Midtown Atlanta. If this is your first time listening to one of our talks, we certainly hope you enjoy it. But if you're a regular listener to our podcast, we would like you to consider contributing to our center. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go on our website, and it's easy to find the button and make a contribution. That will allow us to continue bringing these talks to you on a regular basis in the future. Once again, thanks for listening.
The moment I started coming to this teaching back in 1986, I think it was, over at the Woodruff Arts Center when Kennedy Schultz was a minister, the first day I walked in, I felt pretty comfortable with it. Because just like I've heard so many of you say, most of what I was hearing was stuff I always believed. I just didn't know there was a place that talked about it. You know, I didn't know there were people who got together who actually believed the same stuff that I did. But after coming for a while, I also discovered, to my great surprise, that I had a lot of firmly entrenched preconceived notions in my own mind about God, about life, about the relationships I had with other people that needed to change. I didn't think I did before, but then I figured out that I did, because it turns out that there was some conflict between living my life the way I had been living it and living my life in a new way that reflected the things that I was learning here. I didn't think it was going to be there, but it was. So after I had been coming for a relatively short time, probably 2 or 3 months, I found myself confronting kind of an internal dilemma. It wasn't an existential crisis or anything like that, but it did get me thinking about my former religious upbringing as it compared to this new path that I was beginning to follow. You see, you've heard me tell stories before. In the Catholic school I attended, Clearwater Central Catholic High School in Clearwater, Florida, okay, back in the 60s, about half of the teachers, it wasn't a very big school, maybe a couple hundred kids, and about half of the teachers that we had were a group of nuns who belonged to an order called the Sisters of Mercy. And unlike some of the stories you hear about Catholic schools and nuns and rulers and all this other stuff, they were actually very, very nice, sweet ladies. One of them even liked to play basketball with us during lunch. You know, see her driving for a layup in her full penguin suit. I mean, it was a sight to behold. Anyway, because of their vows for the Sisters of Mercy, and partly because of the kind of people they were, the kind of person who's attracted to that kind of a vocation, these good sisters put a lot of emphasis on the importance of living a compassionate life for them as a means to earn our way into heaven. So they told us stories, even in math and history class, they'd work these stories in, stories like the Good Samaritan, we've all heard that story, and they talked about all of the saints who had given away everything so they could go help the sick or the poor, people like Francis of Assisi, St. Vincent de Paul, now Mother Teresa, all of them, and it made a very strong impression on me at the time and a lot of other Catholic kids who were growing up in what we called then the Age of Aquarius. So this idea of building a compassionate, peaceful planet was very, very powerful then. But when I started getting involved in this teaching, as I started reading the books, in addition to going on Sunday morning and going to the classes, and I tried to practice these new, to me, mental and spiritual principles in all of my affairs, I thought I was hearing what appeared to me to be two conflicting messages. Now, on the one hand, I was hearing about an entirely different way of understanding God as a power, a single power, unified power that was completely loving and accepting of all people equally. I started hearing about a God who had already given to each and every one of us everything we needed to create a life that was filled with vibrant health, extravagant wealth, deep love, and satisfying success. And that was a nice message because those were things that I wanted to get even better in my life too. But at the same time, I also heard the message that every single person in the world is completely responsible for the experiences and the conditions that exist in their life, that each one of us reaps what we sow. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. We are co-creators with God of our experience, all those things you hear me say all the time. And I like that message, too, because that made me feel empowered. It made me feel like life was an opportunity instead of a test or a contest. The problem was, I looked around. I read the news at the time, and I saw a lot of people in the world who were having some very serious problems in their life. Now, I had problems too, but my problems were along the line of first world problems, you know, they call them. They weren't that big a deal. They were nothing compared to the stuff I saw around me. Because I saw people who were living their life every day in mental, emotional, and physical even agony. Agony. I even knew some people like that. I read every day about people who were suffering all over the world from starvation, from war, from disease, and from horrific, irrational acts of violence. There were people around who were in such pain that they contemplated suicide every single day. And we've all known people like that. And it made me sad. I mean, what else? It made me sad. I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to help, okay? I wanted to make their suffering stop. Because I'm one of those people who doesn't like to walk by a person in the street who looks like they haven't eaten for a week and they got a little sign there, especially if they got a dog with them. Everybody go, oh, you know, I mean, we're all, none of us likes that, okay? We can feel it. It touches us. The problem I was running into with all that laid out was one a lot of people have when they first get into this teaching. I was having trouble understanding how the very human quality of compassion could fit into a philosophy of complete personal responsibility. You see the dilemma there? Okay. Because I couldn't just look at people who are suffering and say, gee, I wonder what's in their consciousness. You know, if they think better thoughts, maybe they could create a better life, all right, and then go on my way. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. Even though that is a true statement on a metaphysical level, on an academic and spiritual level, it is also a very simplistic statement of a very complex truth. And it's not a very loving statement either, right? Okay? Especially when it's supposedly coming from someone who believes in a loving, caring, and supportive God, power, which I did. But there are some people, and you probably find more of them in this teaching than the more traditional ones, who try to justify their opinions about other people with that kind of thinking. And when they do, they sound like the guy who says, before you judge another person, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way you'll be a mile away and you'll still have his shoes, you know. That's kind of what it sounds like. I'd hate to think what Leo Biscaglia, remember Dr. Love, anybody remember him? He died about 20 years ago. I'd hate to think that he was right when he said, we were born to love people and use things. Instead, most of us love things and use people. You know, that's what he said. And I hate to think he might be right, because if he is, that's something that we need to change. Because the cold, hard truth is this world and all the people in it, every country, every race, every gender, everything, we need to become more compassionate and less judgmental, or we will not survive. We will not survive. And I think this is becoming extremely obvious to us all. So today I want to talk about how we can do that. How we can actually do that, about how we can live a more compassionate life and empower and support each other in an intelligent, powerful, and constructive way, okay? That's what we need to learn. In other words, I want to talk about how we can use our heart without losing our heads, okay? Or as my teacher, Kennedy Schultz, once used to say, we need to keep our mind open, but not so open that our brains fall out, all right? You see, even though people who believe what we believe sometimes get accused of being selfish, a lot of people talk about these kind of teachings that, oh, you just want to manifest stuff. You just want to get stuff. And we get accused of not being compassionate towards other people who are suffering. Once you understand these ideas, once you understand the spiritual creative power of these ideas, you'll see that that's not true at all. In fact, I have come to believe that this is one of the most compassionate teachings you will ever, ever find. Because the things we talk about here, from the podium, in classes, whatever, these are ideas from personal experience that have pulled a lot of people out of some very deep holes that they had gotten themselves into. And practiced with the right state of mind and heart, these ideas may sometimes look like the metaphysical version of tough love, but it's love just the same. It is love just the same. Anyway, before we go any further, let me get one other thing pulled in. Let's make sure we understand what we're talking about when we use the word compassion. Because compassion is one of those words that's frequently used to manipulate people with guilt. I got a Catholic mother. Let me tell you, it is used, okay? I mean, nobody likes to be accused of being heartless. So we're very vulnerable to people who use sympathy and suffering to pull on our heartstrings. It's like here in Atlanta, you know, you ever been stopped at a red light and somebody just wearing jeans and a t-shirt is walking down with a bucket that says, "Help feed starving children"? And they're walking down, you're going, oh, should I give them some money? Should I roll up the window? Should I pretend I'm on my phone? We do that one a lot, you know. Nobody wants children to starve, all right? None of us do. But there's something about it that makes us think this may not be the best way to solve the problem, you know, by putting a dollar in that bucket. So how do we go about finding a better answer to the big problems? Let's talk about that. First of all, whenever we are faced with a sad situation, and this is what this teaching tells us, whenever we're faced with a sad situation that cries out for compassion, we will always be most effective, not just more effective, but most effective when we allow our mind and our heart to work together. To work together, that's what we are. Because our human emotions are most powerful when they are directed by intelligent thought. You see it all the time. You see, whenever we see someone in pain, in almost every case, what we should be focusing on is not so much the suffering itself, as dramatic and attention-grabbing as that may be, as much as the root cause of the suffering. That's where we need to learn how to look, because that's where the real problem lies. That's where the suffering starts. Now, I know to some people, that may not sound like the most compassionate solution, but if it ends the suffering, all right, it's far better than simply dealing with the surface solution. You see, sometimes the things we do to try and relieve suffering are kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. We just sort of figure we want to do something that'll cover it up so we don't have to look at it anymore. That's what the human race does. Even though it may be, more painful in the short term to do what needs to be done, to go digging around inside the wound, very painful, pull the bullet out, dress the wound, treat the wound, that's going to be more effective in the long run. Now, after you do that, you can kiss it to make it better, if that makes you happier, okay? But you need to get to the root cause of the suffering. In other words, if we focus our considerable power as intelligent spiritual beings, which we are, on removing the cause of the suffering itself will disappear. The suffering will disappear, all right? That's what we call healing, and it is the root of true compassion. Healing is the root of true compassion. In fact, that's what Dr. Ernest Holmes, the founder of this teaching, if you're new here, what he tells us over and over and over again. If we change the cause behind any condition, it will always change the condition. Always, always, always. That's the way this stuff works. And it's easy to see how it works when we're dealing with it on a personal level, with something in our own backyard, like our stuff or our family stuff or this happens to be. But sometimes we may not feel like we're able to do anything directly to affect the cause because it's so far away. Maybe it's on the other side of the world. I mean, like a drought in Africa or a tsunami in Asia or a war in Syria, all these things that are going on. Well, one thing we can do, and this goes along with the idea of keeping our mind and heart together, is to not get caught up in the drama of the situation. And the news media tries to drag us into the drama. Now, we may feel emotional, we may feel morally outraged, but we still should not let our emotions cloud our judgment. I didn't say don't have the emotions, just don't let them cloud our judgment. Why? Because even though it may sound counterintuitive, we can always be more compassionate and more effective if we remain objective. If we remain objective, even though it's not always easy to do. Because we still need to see these challenges, these situations, this is the languaging of it, we need to see them as God sees them. We need to look at these things, and that means with compassion, clarity, and good sense. And those three things are not mutually exclusive. We can be compassionate, we can be clear, but we can keep our mind open. You see, contrary to what a lot of people think, things like war and starvation, and brutality, and terrorism are not inevitable. Some people will try to tell you they are part of the human experience. But that's not true at all. They do not have to exist. They do not have to exist. Now, they may be normal in today's world, but that doesn't mean they are natural. Because there is no suffering, no starvation, no war, no terrorism, none of these things within the mind of God. Within the creative mind of God that we are one with. Problems like war and terrorism and all those other things are a product of limited human consciousness caught up in fear, selfishness, and ignorance. That's all they are. We have created them so we can uncreate them. They come from a destructive mindset that sees itself as different from or as separate from the loving and creative nature of life. That's where they come from. And that kind of thinking needs to be healed. And this type of spiritual approach offers the best opportunity, in my opinion. So what do we do? How do we do this, okay? Well, one thing we can always do, and Doug mentioned this in his words, in the beginning, before anything happens, and to train ourselves to always see things like this, is to simply recognize that all the people involved in a tragic situation are spiritual beings in human form, just like we are. Or they are spiritual beings having a human experience, is the way some people put it. But listen to what I'm saying. Not just some of the people, okay? Not just one side or the other. Everyone involved at every level, top to bottom. Good guys, bad guys, victors and victims, leaders and followers, soldiers and civilians. We need to recognize that the news may be reporting the facts, but it's not reporting any spiritual truths. It isn't, okay? If each and every one of us can fill our mind every day in everything we do with a consciousness of peace and compassion and love for every man, every woman, and every child on earth, the world will begin to change very, very quickly. Very, very quickly. Because a change in consciousness, whether it's in a single person or a city or a country, as Peter's song talked about, is a powerful force. That shift in consciousness, having open compassion and understanding for every person everywhere, can spread like wildfire. It really, really can. If we can help even one person to see a greater possibility and at the same time help to create an atmosphere where that person feels safe and powerful enough to move towards that possibility, okay, we will have done more for them than any amount of money or food or medicine could ever do. And then we can provide those things. That's fine. That's good stuff. But first, we have to provide them with a space. I mean, the word compassion itself means com, meaning with, and passion, meaning emotion. It means to share strong emotion with someone. Positive emotion, obviously, since we're talking about compassion. It means expressing sympathy and support when someone is suffering. But here's the key. It doesn't differentiate whether their suffering was a direct result of good or bad choices they made. And that's very, very important. You see, another part of the problem is our ability to feel compassion for people is tied very closely to our tendency to judge people. It really, really is. If, in our judgment, we feel that they brought the problem on themselves by some action, choice, whatever it is they happen to do, then we aren't as likely to go out of our way to help them as we would be if we just thought they were suffering because of bad luck. That's kind of the mentality we have gotten into, all right? But it gets even more complicated when we believe that every conscious being on the planet is first caused to their own experience. Everything in our life, we created it or attracted it. So where does that take your mind if you're locked into that kind of thinking? Let me see. Then maybe I shouldn't feel compassion for anybody, except children and animals, of course, who are very helpless. Because if, on a metaphysical level, everybody creates their own life experience, then everyone must also be creating their own suffering. Right? Right? Wrong. Okay? Wrong. There are some major problems with this thinking. First of all, if we think this way, we set ourselves up as both judge and jury. When our understanding of what's in someone else's consciousness is extremely limited, It is. We forget that we are no more capable of judging another person's intent or what's in their consciousness than they are in judging ours. And we know how we hate to be judged. I do anyway. Anybody else hate to be judged? Probably several of you. Okay. The truth is, most people we see who are in trouble, whether or not their own behavior put them there, are acting pretty much the same way that we would act given the same circumstances and the same level of awareness. True. So our reaction to their situation, instead of judging and criticizing them, should be compassion and forgiveness. Compassion and forgiveness, they go hand in hand, not judgment and criticism. Or to use a phrase your grandmother probably used, I know mine is, we need to put ourselves in their place. That's called empathy. Empathy, okay? Now, when we do this, something really spiritual happens. When we do, we shift our attitude from critical judgment to empathy and forgiveness. And that's how we help to create an atmosphere where they can actually increase their awareness. Now, their awareness of what? Well, by shifting our consciousness, we can create an atmosphere where they can change their awareness so they don't feel that they are evil or stupid or weak, even though their behavior may appear that way. An awareness that there is a way that they can begin to change their experience, and it begins with changing their core belief. Awareness, people can get the awareness from us that they are powerful spiritual beings who are perfectly capable of creating a better situation than the one they find themselves in now. That kind of awareness, our awareness, will shift theirs. Goethe, the German philosopher, once said, I love this. He said, the way you see people is the way you treat them, and the way you treat them is what they become. Think of that. The way you see people is the way you treat them, and the way you treat them is what they become. That's a very powerful observation, because that means that the first step in helping a person who is suffering, which is the basic definition of compassion, is to change the way we see them. Change the way we see them. In other words, we need to change our consciousness until all we see is the truth behind the appearance. We need to stop seeing people as helpless, suffering victims who won't be able to survive without our generous and enlightened support. Because that doesn't do them any good, and it doesn't do us any good. Eventually they're going to resent it, and eventually we're going to resent it. We need to stop labeling people in terms of compassion and judging. We need to stop labeling someone as a drunk or a drug addict or a homeless person who's too lazy to work or all this other stuff that some people do, because that hurts us more than it hurts them. How? It hardens our heart. It hardens our heart. It causes us to think that there are people and places in the world where God is not present and life is not sacred. And that's not a good thing. We need to start seeing the divine spark of life in every other person, no matter what they're going through. And fortunately, we have a lot of role models. We got the old superstars like Florence Nightingale and Albert Schweitzer and Mother Teresa and countless others whose names we will never hear. And the books these people wrote and the books that were written about them all say the same thing. It's very, very interesting. These books all tell you, the biographies and such, that these people did not give up everything they had because they felt pity for the people they were helping. Not at all. They gave up all they had because when they did, they found something much more valuable. They found life shining, I remember reading, like a diamond in the gutter. Such a beautiful phrase. They found people who were suffering from war and disease and poverty, and they sat with them and they talked with them as one human being to another. That's what they did. Or a better way of saying it might be the deep respect for life in them recognized itself in the other person. That's what they saw, all right? And that even though this other person was broken and filled with pain. So both the giver and the receiver of love were better for the experience. The giver and receiver of compassion. And so was the rest of the world, even if the world itself didn't know it or didn't even notice. People like this are incredible role models. All right, people who can look past the judgment and the blame and the appearance and can look at every other person as their equal in the sight of God have a very special place in the world. And if you've known any of them personally, they have this sense of peace about them. They have this complete sense of calm. They have a firm conviction that every life is precious, whatever way it's being expressed. Whatever way it's being expressed. And that gives them a certain kind of power. It gives them more power than those of us who get caught up in appearances or people who may sort of guard their time and money because somebody may not deserve it and it may cheat us out of what we have, blah, 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 all that stuff. But these people don't have anything that you and I don't have. They're simply seeing something that we've forgotten to look for. They see God in every other person. That's why these people really are in the world but not of it. A great statement. There's one more important reason why we need to be careful to show compassion to every person, everywhere, all the time. Every person, everywhere, all the time. And it's a very simple one that we seem to forget. And it is because we talk a lot about being independent. You know what? We are actually interdependent. Michael Beckwith came up with that, where we are interdependent. That's what the teacher Jesus meant when he said, whatever you do to the least of my brothers, that you do unto me. Whatever we give to others returns to us multiplied abundantly. We say that in our affirmation for the offering. But we're not just talking about money. We're talking about love and kindness and peace, even a smile. You give a smile, you almost always get one back. Mark Twain, who was an amazing man, he once wrote this. He said, I am the entire human race compacted together. I have found, he says, that there is no ingredient of the race which I do not possess in either a small way or a large way. No ingredient of the human race that I do not possess. What he means is, anything we criticize in others exists in some small way in us. Some small way in us. So that means we need to be compassionate, not just to other people, but also to ourselves, especially to ourselves. Most of us would rather go miles out of our way. We'd go without a second thought to help a friend, but we won't give ourselves the benefit of an afternoon nap when we're feeling exhausted. It's true. In the same way, we need to be able to feel compassion for others and to help them without draining ourselves. Without draining, that's called balance, and it's a very spiritual concept. So we have to have a healthy, loving, supportive, life-affirming relationship with ourselves before we can provide that for someone else. So we need to be prosperous so we can help others to prosper. We need to be loving so we can help others to love. We need to be healthy so we can show others how to heal. That's important. It's important. And we're all perfectly capable of doing that. And once we do, and we gain that sense of peace and calm and strength that these superstars of compassion all have, we will be able to provide support for those in the world who could benefit from our support, and our strength will help them to heal and grow until they're able to support themselves. Now, this will work for your next-door neighbor. It'll work for someone who is halfway around the world. We can share our healing consciousness and our compassion in the form of time, money, or even a kind word, whatever. It doesn't matter how we do it. The important thing is that we do it joyfully and habitually. So it becomes virtually automatic. Now, when we do, it won't change God. And it may or may not change the person we're trying to help. But it will definitely change us for the better. Definitely for the better. I want to close with a reading, one of my favorite readings, and it's from Khalil Gibran, the prophet. Most of us have read it going back 40, 50 years, talking about true compassion. And in it, he says this. It's beautiful. It's a paragraph, so bear with me. He said, there are those who give little of the much that they have, and they give it for recognition, and their hidden desire makes their gifts unwholesome. And there are those who have little and give it all. These are the believers in life and the bounty of life, and their purse is never empty. There are those who give with joy, and that joy is their reward. And there are those who give with pain, and that pain is their baptism. But there are those who give, and know not pain in giving, nor do they seek joy or give to show their virtue. They give, as in yonder valley, the flower breathes its fragrance into space. Isn't that beautiful? Into space. Through the hands of such as these, God speaks, and from behind their eyes, he smiles upon the earth. Beautiful, beautiful reading. That's the way we should give of ourselves. As the flower breathes its fragrance into space. Because that's the way life gives itself to us, all right? No judgment, no criticism, no strings attached. No strings attached. The gift of life has been given to us, and it's ours to use in any way we want. And during this time, interesting time in history, of international chaos, financial uncertainty, and political confusion, living a compassionate life is the greatest gift we can give to ourselves and to the world. This is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is. And so it is. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Let's take a moment. Don't hurt yourself. Take your time. There you go. Let's just take a moment. A lot of ideas here. Take those that resonated with you. I give them to you freely. Set aside the others for later. Let's know this. Life is a gift that continually gives itself to me and to everyone. There is one life. It is perfect. That life is expressed as a power that I call God. It is given to me not just with this amazing physical body that is able to play and laugh and love and heal. Not only have I been given the gift of sight to see beauty and the gift of hearing to listen to beautiful music and the gift of touch so I can feel the touch of the one I love. These are great gifts, and I'm thankful for them. But I have also been given the ability to see the presence of God in every person. I've been able to use my mind and my heart to honor others, to respect others, and to give where I can make a difference. I don't need to judge why someone needs my help, whether or not they want to be helped. All of these things will take care of themselves as long as I simply offer back to life what life has given so freely to me. So as I recognize this and I feel myself being transformed, the way I see the world, the way I see other people, completely shifted, I no longer give power to the news stories that try to force me to feel a certain way. I no longer give power to the people and the politicians who try to force me to see others as different, whether it's a different race, a different country, a different religion, whatever it happens to be. Instead, I remind myself that it's all one. One mind, one life, one power, one God. As I recognize this, I am no longer giving of myself to others. I am sharing the Spirit in me with that same Spirit in others. That is how I give. That is how I see others. That is how I give back to life. So knowing this, I accept all that I have been given, and I multiply it abundantly as I give it back. And that resonance, that mutual back and forth of giving and sharing and love and peace expands. The vibration expands until it alters the entire world, one consciousness at a time. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for this awareness. I'm grateful for the life that I have, for the mind that I have, for the heart and the ability to love that I have. And I am grateful for this world wherein we are all here together. Knowing this, every man is my brother, every woman is my sister, every child is my child. We are one family, one life, one planet. I accept this truth completely, I embrace it, and I release it into consciousness, letting it be so. Join me in saying, and so it is.